From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington. Joining me on the panel is Shayna Estulin, Washington correspondent and foreign affairs expert, and Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor at The New Statesman. Here are the issues. The U.S. response to the coronavirus pandemic is turning increasingly political and erratic as U.S. President Donald Trump pushed for an accelerated opening of the U.S. economy and supported the cause of those protesting requirements put in place by the Trump administration. Several governors announced plans to ease restrictions in their states despite not meeting the administration's criteria for a safe opening, a move that President Trump first encouraged in one state and later discouraged. A severe outbreak of COVID-19 at a pork processing plant in the western United States highlighted the dangers the virus presents in sparsely populated states and the potential threat to the national food supply. In Europe, some of the countries that were hardest hit by the coronavirus pandemic are preparing to relax their restrictions. We take a look at the timeline of what happens next and what happens if the coronavirus returns. The U.S. Senate passed a roughly $480 billion relief package that includes hundreds of billions of dollars in new funding for small businesses hurt by the coronavirus outbreak, along with other priorities like money for hospitals and expanded testing. But even as the legislation is being finalized, the next round of assistance is already being planned. And President Trump and New York Governor Andrew Cuomo had a face-to-face meeting at the White House this week, where they discussed the role of the state and federal government in COVID-19 testing and other key issues. We take a look at that meeting and the style and substance of two leaders who hail from the same New York neighborhood and are now at the epicenter of a global pandemic. Panelists, welcome this week as we continue to discuss this pandemic, which places the entire world in an extraordinary situation. I want to start with the U.S. response to the pandemic and how it's turning increasingly erratic, increasingly political. On all sides, we've heard calls for this not to be a political situation, that it is an emergency, that the United States typically does not have partisan politics on, but we have protests of the government policies that are being put in place by the government. And it seems as though the government, the Trump administration, on one hand, disapproves of the protests, while at the same time somehow encouraging them. I want to start with Georgia, Texas, South Carolina. These are among states that are announcing plans to relax or eliminate restrictions. Emily, talk a little bit about the restrictions, what they're planning to do, maybe with Georgia we can start with. And is it too soon for states like that to start talking about reopening?
Yes is the short answer, right? Because we don't have test and trace in place. Georgia is planning on reopening the economy very soon. In Georgia, people will be able to go back to things like gyms. Whether they will or not is still to be seen, right? I personally don't know that I would go work out in a gym given the sort of state of things. But the fact that Governor Kemp is allowing people to go back out, you know, you see people who live in Atlanta tweeting that this will kill people. And it very well could. I understand that people have been hard hit by the economy, quote unquote, shutting down. But I think reframing this such that, you know, it's not that jobs have not been lost because the economy shut down. Jobs have been lost because of the virus, which required the economy to shut down. So to see people in power give precedence to the short-term economic benefit and sort of ignore the long-term, very real health risks, I think is concerning. The only other thing that I would add is that I think that there is this idea that this is somebody else's problem, right? At first, it was sort of in Washington State and it was in New York City, and these are thought to be sort of liberal enclaves and they're the coasts, right? So, well, that's not us. And now, in basically across the country, specifically Black Americans have been hard hit by this virus. And so when you see across the country protests of predominantly white people saying, well, why are we shutting down? This isn't in our state or this isn't in our communities. First of all, yes, it is. And you're currently at an event that could spread this disease. Second of all, you are pushing for a decision, the consequences of which will probably not mostly affect you, right? But somebody will suffer.
But Shayna, I want to go to you with this question because, again, as Emily pointed out, there's all these fault lines. There's economic fault lines. There seem to be racial fault lines. There seem to be geographic differences to a problem that almost by definition requires a universal strategy to try to defeat. Is the president aware of what he seems to be doing in terms of creating a fractured response rather than a unified response? Is that intentional, or is it just a manifestation of his personality as a leader?
Well, you certainly are getting mixed messages from the president about reopening the country. So you have him saying he wants to reopen the country in the beginning of May and saying he alone has the authority to force states to reopen, then backing off. But at the same time, supporting these protests that you guys have been talking about that have been springing up around the country where people are demanding states reopen their economy despite the health risks. But then when Brian Kemp of Georgia says that he's going to open his state, the president says it's a bad idea, it's too soon. Really, I mean, for governors right now, they're walking a tightrope. It's a very difficult balancing act, if I can use that metaphor, because on one hand, they have to protect people's health. But on the other, we are seeing millions and millions of Americans lose their jobs, and millions more could potentially lose their jobs the longer this stretches out. And we're also seeing the virus hit different parts of the country differently. Some places like New York on the East Coast, on the West Coast, were harder hit than, let's say, some states in the middle of the country, even though every state has been affected. And you have this pressure from the president and confusing messages coming from the White House. So it's very difficult for governors to know what they're going to do. But to Emily's point, even when governors say they're going to reopen their states, they can't force businesses to reopen. They can't force people to go shopping or to the nail salon or to the gym. You can't force people to spend money like that. So even when the economy starts reopening, it's likely going to be a very slow reopening and recovery.
This week, there was a quote by U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr speaking about some of the lawsuits that are being planned against the government about the certain states, about the restrictions of the shutdown. Partial quote from him: well, if people bring those lawsuits, we'll take a look at it at that time. And if we think it's, you know, justified, we would take a position. As lawsuits develop, as specific cases emerge in the states, we'll take a look at them. So we have a case where we have grassroots protests, allegedly, and you have the U.S. government saying that it will support lawsuits against the restrictions that it has asked the states to put into place. This was a mind bender for me, Emily. What does this say to you about how the government is handling the situation?
Well, three things. First of all, I do think it's important to note that while there may be grassroots support for some of these protests, they've also reportedly been organized and funded by larger groups. So I think that's just important to note.
Yes.
But actual to the question, two things. First, I think Trump has really muddied the message on exactly what role the federal government is playing in this. So first, he says, I have total authority, and then goes on Twitter and tweets, liberate Virginia, liberate Michigan. So it's sort of, well, which are you? Are you all powerful, or are you, you know, completely helpless sitting by watching this, calling on people to rise up against their states? That's confusing for governors. It's also confusing for people just trying to make sense of what's going on right now at this very confusing time. Second of all, it's not fair to say that there's been no federal response, but the sort of timeline here has not been clearly articulated by the federal government, which is difficult because it puts these different governors in difficult positions. And I could understand why Trump would want them to have to make that call, even if he then turns around and says, no, I disagree with that call. I understand that different states and different parts of the country were hit differently, but the virus doesn't stop at a state border, right? So if you reopen one state, well, what happens to the state right nearby? This is part of the reason that the Mid-Atlantic and the Western states have sort of form these clusters. Finally, I think it's worth noting that wrote a piece on this and what these protests have in common with other recent protests, like the Bundy standoffs, like the Tea Party movement, is that there's a real sense of grievance, right? You see people waving the Confederate flag and likening themselves to rebels. You see people comparing themselves to Holocaust survivors, which frankly, I think both of those things are completely ludicrous, but—
Let me throw in Rosa Parks, the Rosa Parks comparisons that I found ludicrous. Thank you.
None of you are Rosa Parks or Anne Frank. That's not a subjective statement at all. That is a statement of fact, but there's this sense of grievance. And so when you have Bill Barr saying, oh, we'll take a look at the lawsuits, I mean, sure, maybe he has to say that people have a right to bring a lawsuit, but it could also be interpreted, right, as the federal government saying, yes, you're right to that, to have that grievance. You are being hurt here. When in fact, the policies against which they're pushing are, while deeply painful, and I don't want to make light of anybody's economic pain and the real hurt the millions of Americans are feeling, but those policies, you know, I can't believe I have to say this, but the difference between those policies and the policies that Holocaust survivors endured is that these are meant to keep you safe.
Indeed. And I'll give you the last word on this one. Shana, again, the government response in your mind, it seems to me as though there's, again, this confusion that Emily points out. Your thoughts on that?
You know, I've been looking at countries around the world and how they're responding, and no one's getting it perfect. This is unprecedented. We've never had a pandemic. But you are seeing here in the U.S., it certainly seems to be more confusing than in other countries. And part of that is that we're a country made up of states who enjoy a high level of autonomy and states' rights and states' authority. And you have other countries where it's much more top-down, where the government controls things in a way that we don't have here in the U.S. But we also have a president who has been accused of being overly optimistic and sort of throwing out ideas without having data or science to back it, and then changing his mind repeatedly. And when you have state governors who have to really make those decisions about putting in place social distancing measures or relaxing them, you really need a leader who's clear about what the guidelines are coming from the federal government. And a lot of state governors are saying that's just not what they're getting.
We're going to take a quick break right there, and we'll come back with more Issues in the News. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on VOA's website at voanews.com. Now, back to our panel, Shana Estulin, Washington correspondent and foreign affairs expert, and Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor at The New Statesman. Panelists, I want to go to a topic that sort of gives us a good segue and sort of exposes the fault lines that we were talking about and how all the states are connected despite any differences that may be perceived because of geography, because of race, all these things. There was an outbreak at a privately owned pork factory in South Dakota, a pork processing plant. I believe over 700 cases were reported from the one factory. The workforce is largely made up of immigrants and refugees. Questions remain about what the company did to protect its staff. The plant is closed now, cutting off 5% of the nation's pork supply. The company itself says that the outbreak is a problem with cultural issues amongst its employees. That being the case, South Dakota is a state with very few people, and you still have this huge outbreak. And people have previously tried to say that it just could only happen in states where you have a dense population like New York, New Jersey, and so forth. Emily, I'll go to you. Any thoughts on how this happened and what this says about the connectedness of the states, that this really could happen, that the outbreak can happen anywhere at any time?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two related issues here. The first is that, as you say, and as we've been saying, yes, this is more concentrated in some parts of the country and in some states than others, but viruses travel, and this is a highly contagious virus. That's why it's a pandemic. There's a reason that people were saying to people in New York City, please don't leave, right? Please don't go to the Berkshires. Please, if you have, you know, your parents' house in Maine, don't go there, because what will happen is that if you are already infected, you will bring it to these areas that don't have the resources that New York City has, right? Where there's one hospital. And so it's suddenly completely overwhelmed because somebody from New York came and infected everybody. The other issue is that I think the company's comments on this being down to the culture of their employees is anybody can get this virus, anybody can spread this virus. And it speaks to the differences that not everybody can stay home during this virus. And you have what you have seen, and not just in this factory, but throughout the country, is workers who need to go to work and need to continue doing their jobs, without whom we, grocery store employees, for example, here in Washington, D.C., the P Street Whole Foods, there was an outbreak among the staff. This idea that, oh, everybody is so vulnerable to this virus and this is the great equalizer. We are vulnerable to it, but some of us are at greater risk. And it is on their employers to make sure that they have proper equipment, that they can be safe, that they can stand a certain distance from each other. If we want to talk about culture, what was the culture in that factory, right? What was provided to the employees? Were they given an opportunity to keep themselves as safe as possible? Because across the country, what we are seeing in warehouses, in grocery stores, in factories, is that the answer to that has been no, not really.
Shana, thoughts on what this says about the vulnerability of small states that have large concentrations in private facilities?
as Emily pointed out, everybody is vulnerable. And it's not only happening at this particular meat processing plant, we're seeing it happen at other meat processing plants throughout the country where the virus is spreading. People are working shoulder to shoulder and complaining that they don't often have the proper protection. And it's not only at these meat processing plants, it's also farm workers who are picking our produce, and they're at risk too. And they're also complaining that they don't have proper protection. And this is all happening at a time when people are feeling skittish and panicky about going to the grocery store in general. These outbreaks among these essential workers, not only the health risks to them, but what it would mean for people who want to bring food home from the grocery store. So yes, very vulnerable, not only these states, but really the entire country's food supply.
I want to segue real quick to Europe. Some of the countries that were hardest hit by the virus are preparing to relax their restrictions. We have Spain and Germany that are opening up. Austria is planning to reopen. Shayna, I'll stay with you. Talk a little bit about the countries that are opening up, their methodology for doing this, and what the U.S. can learn from the arc of the pandemic in these countries.
Yeah, I've definitely been looking at Europe because Europe is ahead of the U.S. on the virus timeline, on the virus's timeline. So we could get a sense of how Europe responds, how they start reopening up their businesses and their economy. And then if we see a spike in cases there, what that could mean for here in the U.S. Germany is a country I'm really looking at because their leader, Angela Merkel, is a scientist by training. And so she's really trying to base her decisions on data, on science. And Germany also has widespread testing in a way that we don't have here in the US. And so they're now going ahead and loosening some restrictions. But even Angela Merkel is warning that people shouldn't be too eager and rush out to stores and to shops because all the gains they've made with widespread testing and the social distancing lockdowns and measures, that all could be erased if people go out in big crowds and you have people sick again.
Emily?
Merkel is, when you listen to her speak about this, it's, you know, okay, right now we can reopen because it's a one-to-one contagion effect. And if we do this right, then we'll reach our max hospitalization in, I think she said November. She's like, and then if it becomes 1.1 is the spread, one person to every 1.1 people, then it becomes July. And if it's 1.2, then we're in June and we'll need to shut this down again. There is a real method and it's really based on the data. And they are able to do that again, because they have widespread testing, which we do not have. So I think for Americans looking at Europe saying, well, that could be us. No, it can't, even if the same amount of time has elapsed, because they have in place measures that we just don't have right now.
Let's move to the economic relief package, the latest economic relief package. Again, about $480 billion of relief that includes small business funding and the next round of small business funding. It's more money for testing. It did not include money for relief for states, which are asking for assistance from the federal government to handle things like the testing, the additional services that are required to respond appropriately to the pandemic. The bill was held up for a while as people wanted to get more things in. Emily, I'll stay with you. Did both parties get most of what they wanted in this bill?
I think the general line on this one is that literally saw a reporter tweet out, Democrats cave, because they didn't. I understand that. You know, there obviously there's a time crunch here. People are really hurting. Small businesses need money to stay afloat. But, you know, Democrats had wanted more funding for states and cities. And the response was, well, that's unrelated, which I kind of don't get. But that's another matter. Funding for vaccine testing was seen as a concession by Republicans to Democrats. It's kind of concerning. I don't understand how that's a political or partisan issue. But the line on this is that there will be a fourth package, and that maybe Democrats will have more say in that one, but we will see.
And Shayna, I'll go back to you. As I mentioned in the open, there is another program, another package that's being discussed right now that has something to do with the states, that they should be a part of that. And President Trump mentioned that during this past week, as did Governor Cuomo, who we'll talk about in a minute. However, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that the states should absolutely not get more help, and that the states, if they can't cover their expenses that are incurred because of this pandemic, that they should, quote, declare bankruptcy. Your thoughts on that quote and what it expresses about the extreme partisan divide when it comes to the states?
Well, you know, I'm always a bit of an optimist. So despite, you know, Washington being Washington and these partisan fights we're seeing, we have also seen both parties coming together and passing several of these bipartisan relief packages. But yes, the partisan bickering remains, obviously. And Mitch McConnell is now saying he wants to put a pause on another relief package because he's worried about the national debt ballooning. But, you know, with the White House and the president in favor of another relief package, the president tweeted that a couple of days ago. He wants to see funding for state and local governments. He wants to see funding for infrastructure. You imagine that even if Republicans are saying we want to slow this down now, at some point there'll be enough pressure from the White House and they will fall in line.
Emily.
On Mitch McConnell's statement that states should declare bankruptcy. The idea that New York, which provides so much economically to this country, needs to declare bankruptcy because Mitch McConnell has remembered the national debt is sort of it's a political twist that I perhaps should have seen coming, but didn't. It comes across as partisan bickering, I think, to many Americans. I agree that at some point the White House will realize that businesses are hurting and do not have enough money and that states need relief and local governments need relief, that there will be sufficient pressure to kind of encourage Republicans to pass another package.
It's worth mentioning that states in their constitutions and charters are very often not allowed not only to go bankrupt, they're not allowed to even run a deficit.
Right, exactly. So what are we talking about?
Indeed. With that, let's go on to the meeting between President Trump and New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. They had a face-to-face meeting. They've been talking on the phone, I think, fairly frequently, according to both of them. They had a face-to-face meeting in Washington this week where they talked about testing. They talked about really the role of the federal government and the state government addressing this pandemic. They say that they had a productive meeting. When you have these two leaders who are both from the same neighborhood in Queens, and you see two very different personalities, two very different styles of management, I'll open with you, Shana. When you look at President Trump and President Cuomo in that meeting, it seemed to be almost as much symbolic as it was just a practical meeting. What are your takeaways from that meeting?
Well, as somebody who lived in New York for 7 years, I can tell you that Cuomo has had his share of critics, especially people living in New York City who have to take the subway. The subway's got tons of problems and the governor controls the subway system. So you've heard a lot of people complaining about the governor, but he has become this national figure now. It's really his shining moment. His press briefings are must-watch TV. And I think if you contrast Cuomo to President Trump, it sure seems like a lot of Americans are starved for somebody who's speaking with authority, who seems to be sympathetic to what Americans are going through, but is also cautiously optimistic. And so a lot of people are tuning in to what Cuomo is saying. And Cuomo's also really pragmatic. He gets, as do some other governors and world leaders as well, that if you want something from President Trump, you've got to flatter him. And so he came all the way to D.C. to talk to Trump, and he did get something that he wanted, which is more help for testing. Cuomo was asked about this meeting by reporters, and in his typical blunt New York style, he said, look, we're not getting married. We don't have to like each other, but you've got to put aside political differences if you want to get the job done.
Emily, I'll give you the last word on that meeting. Is Cuomo being now considered for a role in a possible Biden administration?
He certainly maybe. I think that he's gained a lot of national attention and praise for his handling of this crisis, which is interesting because actually there are some who say, well, New York could have shut down earlier and we should be looking more to the example of Gavin Newsom in California and Jay Inslee in Washington State. Cuomo and Trump have had this very interesting relationship where they'll say, we're getting along great, and then they'll sort of lash out at each other. And there was one such briefing where Cuomo was, before he came to Washington, sort of saying, what is Trump going to do? Grant me the Constitution from before he was born? And he kind of sounded like Trump, because these two men are, as I am, from New York and sort of learned to speak in a certain way. So it's just been interesting to watch how similar the cadences and manner of expression can be at the same time as the content of what is being said is so different. And yet here we are. So, yeah, I think the meeting was a productive one, and one hopes that it will alleviate some pain for New York and for New Yorkers.
Indeed. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this week. My thanks to Shana S. Dulin, Washington correspondent and foreign affairs expert, and Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor at The New Statesman. This program is produced by VOA's Kim Lewis, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.